From www.famicomdojo.tv and Powit Radio International, it's This Famicom Life. I'm Vink. Each week in our show, we bring you a game, and then present you variations on that game. This week, filler. Stories that fill time when we can't do a full podcast. Our story in four acts today. Act 1, Pachinko. Act 2, Remembering the GameCube Launch. Act 3, Japanese RPG, and Act 4, Vending Machines. Stay with us. Act 1, Pachinko. This story was originally recorded shortly after the launch of the Game Boy Micro. It's about the state of pachinko in Japan. A lot has changed in games since the Game Boy Micro, but pachinko is mostly the same. Like most stories you will hear today, there's some audio fuzz in the background, but please pretend that you are nostalgically playing this podcast through a dubbed cassette on a low-priced stereo system.
Right now, in my town, the Game Boy Micro is completely sold out. The game stores don't have any, and the toy stores don't have any. I noticed this, but it is really not very important to me. You see, I don't feel that I'm stylish enough to own a Game Boy Micro. If I had a Game Boy Micro, it would just make the rest of my wardrobe look shabby in comparison. I don't need that kind of stress in my life. However, if I did want to buy one, there's still one place I could get it. I could go to a pachinko parlor. Okay, for those of you new to the concept of pachinko, let me explain. Pachinko is like pinball, but without the fun. Okay, that is not really fair to say. After all, the pachinko industry is far more popular than the arcade industry, and far, far, far more common. I live in a fairly small town, and there are 8 pachinko parlors within walking distance of my house, compared to 1 arcade. So let me start over. Pachinko is like pinball, but without the control. What you do is buy a bucket of these little metal balls, about an eighth the size of a pinball, and feed them into the machine. From there, you can, with a crank, determine how hard the balls are shot out. From that point, all you can do is watch and, I would assume, pray that they go into the right holes, flippers, ramps, etc., which will make the lights light up, bells ding, music play, anime girls disrobe, etc., etc., all in the hopes that more balls that you put in will come out. It is very Japanese in that way. Let the balls go and leave the rest to fate. Okay, assuming you did great, and that you didn't die of asphyxiation from all the cigarette smoke in the parlor, you can take your winnings, usually in the form of large plastic tubs filled with tiny metal balls, up to the counter. The lady in the counter, in the short miniskirt that distracts you from the fact that you have spent your entire paycheck and afternoon playing Destiny pinball, will weigh the tubs. You can then exchange the points you have earned for one of the fabulous prizes, one of which, at my local parlor, is a Game Boy Micro. There are also GameCube games, DVD players, tablecloths, perfumes, chocolates, you name it. My friend's aunt actually did all of her Christmas shopping at a pachinko parlor one year. No lie. But what if you want money? Well, you see, gambling in Japan is technically illegal. But like everything else in the world, there is a loophole. What you're going to want to do is look for the items that are both the most pathetic and the most expensive. For example, pencils that are worth the equivalent of $50 or $400 keychains. Take these items and go across the street or around the corner. Just look and you will find a very small building with a window in front and a bored-looking old lady behind it. Give her the collection of random objects you have acquired. She has obviously been looking for pencils that say 31 pachinko on them for ages, because she will reward you with cash for them. Okay? Convenient, no? 2 years ago, my American friend studying in Japan went to a pachinko parlor with his host father and won big. Really big. But he didn't really realize what was going on. He didn't know how to play and wasn't even sure he was winning. His host father helped him out with the balls he had acquired. When his host father returned, he was handed 3 pencils and a candy bar. Seeing these things, he thought to himself that he must not have done as well as he thought, and proceeded to eat the most expensive candy bar he has ever had. What he should have done, of course, was to exchange that candy bar for money, and exchange that money for fashionable clothes, and then he could have bought a Game Boy Micro to go with his new look. That's what I would have done.
Act 2. The GameCube launch.
When I first heard of the GameCube, then called Dolphin, I decided that I wasn't getting one. Before this, I had bought every Nintendo system, or at least begged my parents to buy them for me. Yes, this includes the Virtual Boy. But at this time, I was so disappointed with the N64. I know that's blasphemy, and the N64 did have a ton of great games, Mario 64 being one of my favorite games of all time. But it just didn't have enough of the type of games I like to play. Mainly RPGs, side-scrollers, fighters, and just, well, 2D games in general. Sure, they were there, but they were few and far between and really expensive. So I was prepared to sit this generation out. I was happily playing my Dreamcast at the time. Until it was discontinued, that is. The death of the Dreamcast hit me hard. There are only 2 systems that I would ever consider myself a fanboy of, and the Dreamcast was one of them. For a while, I had even decided that I would just never buy a new system again and play the thousands of old games I never got around to. But even I'm not that old-school hardcore. I had to move on. But where to go next? At the time, the PS2 had nothing I was looking for, and I still sort of resented it from the time I was a Dreamcast fanboy. As a gamer who plays mostly Japanese games, the Xbox was out. It also annoyed me that Peter Moore, who was then still with Sega before moving to Microsoft, decided not to release Shenmue 2 on the US Dreamcast, and instead made it an Xbox exclusive in North America. That just annoyed me right there. So I decided to start following the developments of the Nintendo GameCube. I hate to say how it is that I made this choice, but at the time, GameCube was simply the new system that I hated the least. But as it got closer to the release day, I started to get more excited. Overworks, the makers of Skies of Arcadia, said that they would be doing a game for the GameCube. Little did I know that it was the same game, Skies of Arcadia, but I was excited nonetheless. Sonic was going to the Cube, and Nintendo was even in talks with Squaresoft, who was still Squaresoft back then, rather than Square Enix. It was starting to look pretty good. I already had a DVD player, so I was all for Nintendo's games first motto and not to focus on the extras. About a month before the system launched, I started my semester at Nagasaki Gai Gokugo Tanki Daigaku, the Nagasaki College of Foreign Language in Japan. One of my best friends was studying there as well, and we were both getting stoked for the system launch, and of course lamenting the fact that the Dreamcast was on the way out. I used to watch Japanese TV, and the pre-launch GameCube ads were pretty cool. They made the GameCube look really small and slick. I didn't realize exactly how small and slick it really was until I saw it at a kiosk at a Toys R Us. But I do have to admit, I was not floored by the graphics. At the time, I was used to the graphics on the Dreamcast, and the step up to the GameCube was not as dramatic as, say, the PlayStation to PS2 or the Nintendo to the Super Nintendo. Still, they looked pretty good, and Luigi's Mansion was pretty fun. The GameCube was going to launch in Japan with only 3 titles at first: Wave Race, Blue Storm, Super Monkey Ball, and Luigi's Mansion. In the next few weeks, Super Smash Bros. And Pikmin would follow, but they were not there on launch. I still didn't know if I would buy one right away, but I was looking forward to the launch, which was coming up in a few days. Then it happened. 9/11. The launch of the GameCube came and went, and I didn't even notice. In Japan, the GameCube launched on September 14th, 2001. a mere 3 days after the tragic events of 9/11. During this time, I was not thinking about system launches or games at all. I was wondering if everyone I knew was safe, and wondering what was going on in my home country. I watched all the images come in on the TV and tried to read as much news off the internet as I could. I didn't know when planes would be flying again. I didn't know how I was going to get home. I was far away from home, and it seemed very far away from reality. I was born after the Vietnam War, and the Cold War was something I mainly knew about through video games like Contra and Russian Attack, and seemed very, very far from reality. Luckily, I had amazing support from my friends and the Japanese people around me. My Japanese friends and host family helped me in ways I can never really repay. Gradually, life resumed. So much so that one day, weeks later, my friend, on a whim, bought a GameCube and Super Monkey Ball. Okay, this game is pretty simplistic, but at the time, it was almost the killer app for me. We spent countless hours playing Monkey Fight, Monkey Race, Monkey Golf, Monkey Bowling, Monkey etc., etc. I know this sounds strange for two adults, but my home country at this time was going to be in a real war, and real people that I knew were going to be there. The last thing I needed at this time was a first-person shooter game. This was colorful, simple, fun. I think I may have logged more hours into Super Monkey Ball than any other game on the system, with the exception, of course, of the next game, Super Smash Bros. Melee. I guess this is the game that finally sold the system for me. Great graphics, balanced gameplay, and a huge nostalgia factor. So many things to unlock, so much fun to be had. It also helped that the game was able to switch into English, so I didn't have to feel like I was studying while I was playing my game. We used to bring the GameCube to the lounge of our school and hook it up for a few rounds between classes. The best part was calling my friends in America to brag that we had played the system so far in advance. The GameCube cost the equivalent of about $220 at the time, and the games were about $55 each. I still like the tiny, transparent Japanese cases better than the full DVD cases they package games in America. For some reason, they just feel more high-tech, but I can't really explain why. I didn't have my own system when I returned to America, but a few months later, my friend tired of the system and traded it to me for my extra Neo Geo CD system. Another friend of mine, who had the proper tools to help me, modded it to play US as well as Japanese games. This cube of mine has made the trip between America and Japan 4 times now. It's so small that it always travels with me. I wish I could tell you a story about waiting in long lines on launch day and getting one of the first GameCubes. About meeting with fellow Japanese game players and sharing our excitement about the GameCube's launch. But for me, the GameCube launch will remain a subdued memory. And I will remember those first few days with the GameCube not so much for the amazing graphics or new control, but the healing effect it had on me. You see, I could get back into gaming rather than sit around the TV waiting for the newest world news to filter in. I will remember the GameCube as a system that helped me, even though just in a small way, to help get my life back on track. For that reason, I will always have a special place in my memory for the GameCube.
Act 3. Imari Tones. Listeners of the Famicom Dojo podcast are very familiar with the Imari Tones song, RPG, which has become our main theme song since it was recorded. But most people have not heard the other version of the song, which is in Japanese. This version does not appear on any of the Imari Tones albums, and we'd like to play it for you here now. Thank you. Act 4. Vending Machines.
The Japanese may not have invented the vending machine, but they made it into art. Loud, obnoxious, ubiquitous, overpriced art. And if you don't know what ubiquitous means, it means that they are found everywhere. And you can look up this word in a dictionary that, yes, they sell in vending machines. Vending machines in Japan are called Jido Hambaiki, and this is the best word ever. Especially if you say it like Jido Hambaiki! But I digress. You can buy almost anything in vending machines. In the summer, you can buy cans of cold soda, energy drinks, iced tea, and cold coffee. In the winter, the same machines will dispense hot coffee, hot tea, and hot corn soup. Cold soda can be bought year-round. You can also buy magazines, newspapers, toys, and bags of rice. You can also get DVDs, adult videos, and children's videos, sometimes in the same machine. You can buy books, digital cameras, iPods, CDs, and fresh eggs. You wouldn't believe what you can buy in vending machines in love hotels. Well, maybe you would. Cigarette machines are also extremely common and are found in many public places. This is very different from America, where these machines can only be found in bars and other places where an ID is required to enter. And of course, they're the infamous beer vending machines. When I first came to Japan, these things were everywhere, but now they're becoming less common and usually only found outside liquor stores. Yet, despite the availability of being able to buy beer without an ID, Japan has a lower underage drinking rate than America. Goes to show that if you make it too easy, it becomes less cool. Okay, now everyone has this strange idea that there are vending machines in Japan that sell panties. Why does everyone think this? Probably because it's true. These machines do exist. I saw one in a karaoke place once. I couldn't help wondering what the logic of this was. Oh no! My song's up next, and I just realized I need panties! I suppose it could happen. You can also buy hot food. My favorites are the vending machines that dispense hot dogs and fried chicken. It's not great cuisine, but it's hot and it's ready in about 75 seconds after you put your coins in. Vending machines really are everywhere, too. I was hiking in the mountains once on a dirt path. I hadn't seen any houses, roads, or actually any signs of human civilization for miles, and then glowing like some magical beacon was a Coke machine. I don't know where the electricity was coming from or who restocks the thing, but there it was. One of the odd things about vending machines is that they are often placed outside of 24-hour convenience stores. Inside these stores, you can get the same products for a lower price, sometimes much lower. Yet I always see people using these. Is time so valuable that even the convenience store is no longer convenient enough? And then there are games. Yes, popular video games are available in vending machines. Also, recently I've seen some portable systems, such as the DS and Game Boy Micro units available in these machines. I haven't seen any PSPs, but probably because they're worried about the thing getting scratched as it drops down in the machine. Although, actually, most of these have little windows that open up after you pay your money, so you don't have to worry about that. But some of them do still have games that drop down from the rotating coil. You know how you pay money and sometimes that bag of Cheetos just doesn't drop all the way down? You know, it just hangs there, mocking you, and you have to buy a second one just to get the first one down? I can imagine many impatient Japanese gamers who now have two copies of Star Fox Adventures for that very reason. Okay, but here is the weirdest thing of all. In all of the time I've been in Japan, I have seen almost everything in vending machines. However, in all of these vending machines, there's one thing that I have never found. I have never found a candy bar. Not once. They just don't seem to sell them in vending machines. You can buy them at the stores, no problem, but never in the machines. You can buy frozen squid in vending machines in Japan, but not candy bars. I think Japan is just doing this to confuse me. I explained this to one of my Japanese friends once, and she said, "You sell candy in vending machines? That's weird." You know, maybe it is. Okay, I'm off to buy some bowling shoes, which, yes, also come from vending machines. This is Vink reminding you of that famous Japanese haiku, "Exact change only, the sound of turning dials, formal singing shorts."
I'd just like to add on the end of this vending machine story that a lot's changed since this was originally recorded about 7 years ago. These days, it's very rare to see video games in vending machines, although you do find them in the like crane game UFO catchers. You can still see them there. But for the most part, other than a few portable games at airports, the video game vending machines have mostly gone away. Well, that's all for the show this week. This program was brought to you today by me, with additional help from my old hard drive. If you'd like to listen to this and all of our podcasts, please search for Famicom Dojo on iTunes or the Stitcher Smart Radio app. Management oversight by my boss, Mr. Sean Orange, who is wrong when he tells me,
"I don't feel that I'm stylish enough to own a Game Boy Micro."
See you next week with more stories of this Famicom life.